Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a listener in Florida has a Japanese beetle-like bug eating her plants at night. It sounds like the Asiatic beetle to me. There's just one problem. And we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about control of all these bad beetles in the question of the week. Up until then, it's all of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Carol. How are you?
Well, I'm good, and I'm in northeastern Oklahoma, a town called Pawhuska, about 50 miles north of Tulsa.
Great people in Tulsa.
I'm a supporter and listener to KRPS out of Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Right. However. Thank you for that support. What can we do for Carol in Oklahoma?
Well, the daytime temperatures are getting up into the 70s now, and the mosquitoes are out.
Right.
I am wondering how cool the nighttime temperatures have to be to keep them from laying eggs. I don't want to have to put out all my mosquito dunks just yet.
Well, I mean, it's kind of the reverse of putting out your tomatoes. Everybody gets itchy, plants their tomatoes a little too early, and then they get a big chill one night when the temps drop into the low 40s, and the plants are set back 2 or 3 weeks. I think you're looking at the reverse. We've been doing a lot of talking with experts lately, and we're going to be having a lot of features about mosquitoes in upcoming shows. And the money says that the sooner you can clean out your gutters and start treating water outside with BTI and cleaning up any water-holding trash, the better. I mean, you said 70 degrees, overwintering mosquitoes. They're going to come out. They're going to try to take a blood meal. And they can have a family in a week. Why risk it if you've got the ammunition to use against them?
Okay, I'll start putting it out. We have robins in the bird bath, and the honeybees are flocking all over the henbit, which people pull up as a weed, but it's blooming. It's purple, blooms all over the place, and the honeybees love it. So please don't pull up the henbit.
Oh, no, no, no. Anything is good for bees. Yeah, and that's your sign. Yeah, you might be behind. Get that BTI out and get your gutters cleaned.
The other thing is I have rust on my hollyhocks, and I don't know what to use except copper.
Okay. Well, you know, copper or sulfur, those are the traditional things. Is there anything you can do to improve their airflow? Are they mulched with anything?
Well, I just need to rake up some of the old debris that's at their base. That'll probably do quite a bit to help them.
I think so. And what my friends Lee Reich and Howard Garrett recently talked about on my 17th anniversary show is instead of trashing that infected material, they really insist the way to prevent these diseases is to run that infected material through your compost bin. And I started to think back to maybe they're echoing the true origins of what J.I. Rodale and Sir Albert Howard and the German tradition of biodynamic gardening. Isn't this what it was all about? Was correcting imbalance. And how different is it than vaccination against a disease like polio? You put a little bit of these disease spores in there, and then you've got billions of other microorganisms to interact with them. They really opened my eyes. One, you've got the guy who is considered to be the small fruit expert in America and one of the biggest experts on pruning, and Howard Garrett, the dirt doctor from down in Texas, who has done organic agriculture and landscaping on a large scale successfully and has earned the respect of all the university people down there. Now, you know, I felt like a pair of brown shoes in a room full of mosquitoes.
Me too. I was surprised. I thought, well, you got to bag that up and get it out of there.
Well, and that was the old thinking, and that was the thinking that I repeated over and over again. But I honestly believe that they could be on to something. And as Lee said, you take a close look at any leaf you're about to put into your compost pile. Tell me you're not going to find something wrong with it. Tell me it looks absolutely perfect, like a picture in an upscale gardening book. And they were adamant that the way to combat these diseases is to introduce small amounts of this organism into a hugely composting, rich, earth-like environment and then spread the result. So I would, yes, advise you to rake up the trash underneath, because now it's a direct vector, but to run it through your compost pile and just make sure that the compost is finished before you put it back under there, and do anything you can to improve the airflow to the area and to the inside of the plant. And as you know, this doesn't happen every year. It happens during your humid seasons.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Carol.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Eldon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Eldon. How are you, sir?
Just fine. Thank you.
And where is Eldon fine, may I ask?
I'm from Abingdon, Virginia. That's in far south Virginia near Bristol.
What can we do for Eldon in Abingdon?
Well, I have grapes and I have hazelnuts, and the Japanese beetles attack them every year. So I have not done anything to stop them except use traps before, and it really didn't work very well for me. I have looked into the possibility of using milky spore fungus, but I have not spread that or tried that. And then neighbors have said that I should use seven dust or seven spray, which I have not wanted to do either. So I was wondering if you had some alternative cure for those.
Oh, yeah. And you tell your neighbors they're crazy. Seven is one of the most toxic insecticides that you can use. Okay. And humans exposing themselves to that stuff is just, to me, unimaginable. People who don't grow grapes don't realize how much Japanese beetles love grapevines. I mean, everybody knows they go after our roses. But grapevines are probably their second favorite plant. And unfortunately, I know there's a lot of emotional satisfaction to using Japanese beetle traps, because you love to get that big bag full of like hundreds of beetles and do something terrible to it. But the traps, the lures attract so many more beetles to your area that you actually double the amount of damage when you use traps. And these are Japanese beetles, you're pretty sure. And you have a lawn.
Yeah, yeah.
What you would do is you would find a good source of milky spore powder. It has to be put down in the late summer. They'll sell it to you in the spring. They'll tell you it works in the spring, but it doesn't work in the spring. Milky spore powder will only kill Japanese beetle grubs if the beetle grubs are actively feeding in the soil and the soil temperature is 70 degrees or higher. That's measured 4 inches down. Beetle grubs don't feed in the spring. They only feed in the fall. And, of course, the soil temperature takes forever to get to 74 inches down in the spring. So if you spread your milky spore powder, say, around August 15th, you'll maximize the effectiveness. Not only will it kill all the grubs in your lawn, but every grub will turn into a little milky spore factory and inoculate your lawn so that no grubs can live there for decades to come. And it's totally safe for you and wildlife and all the incredible water sources that you have in that area. This year, you've got two options. One fascinating thing we've learned about Japanese beetles is when they first emerge and they're searching out their plants, once they find a plant like a rose bush or a grapevine, they will send out a pheromone signal to the other Japanese beetles in the area to come and join them. And this initiates a feeding frenzy. And these are the same pheromones that are used in the traps to call Japanese beetles. The more beetles you have, the more pheromones, the more beetles attack, the more they're attracted to it. But if you keep your plants out of their grasp during the first 2 weeks of their emergence, they will all release these pheromones on other people's plants and leave yours alone. So, for instance, you have two options. You can either cover your grapevines with sheer curtains or a substance called Rime, floating row cover, which is used to protect like lettuce fields against insect damage. You'll find it at any better garden center. There's also a product called Surround, which is a clay spray, which is really useful on fruits like your grapes. But it's just a micronized clay that you mix with water and you spray on your plants. and it covers them with a thin clay film that doesn't interfere with photosynthesis, but insects won't come near it. So if when the first Japanese beetles come out, you spray your grapevines with clay, they won't feed on the leaves. Again, they'll establish themselves somewhere else. And if all you do is protect your plants for the first 2 weeks that the beetles are out, they won't come back to your plants later on in the summer. They will have already established their feeding ground elsewhere.
Okay.
So you protect your plants for the first 2 weeks right after you see your first beetles in the spring, and then you spread milky spore powder on your lawn in August, and that should be it. Your grapevine should be yours alone in the seasons to come.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Eldon.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for Mike to take a little break while I announce that he will appear in the Gardener's Studio at the Philadelphia Flower Show at 6 p.m. on Thursday, March 10th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with good news about bad beetles and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Alexis Landis, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, there is a new way to control all of those nasty scarab beetles, June beetles, the night-feeding Asiatic beetles, the Oriental beetle, the notorious Japanese beetle, rose chafer beetles, and weevils as well. These weevils will wobble once you learn what to do. But for now, it's your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Herbert, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing fine, Herbert. How are you, sir?
I'm not doing too bad. I wanted to share with you my experience with some elm trees down in Middletown, Delaware.
Okay. Middletown, Delaware. You actually say elm trees.
Yes. We moved into a development 10 years ago. The development planted trees along the curb, and the trees that were planted along the curb suffered from what I was told was elm tree disease. And over the last 3 to 4 years, the trees started not blooming, looking very bad, and then they just did not bloom last year. So what I ended up having to do was I cut the two trees down that were in front of my home.
Right.
And I talked to several arborists, and they've told me that a lot of the elm trees in North America have come down with some type of blight or some type of disease, and it's nothing you can do.
Yeah, a disease called Dutch elm disease wiped out most of the elm trees in the United States, but this was ages and ages ago. Now, there are trees called Chinese elms that are unaffected, although the American elm, when it wasn't being dropped down by Dutch elm disease, was a good tree for cities.
There were about maybe 20 to 30 trees along the block that were affected. Now, my neighbor, her trees, she was able to water them, and she kind of saved hers, but I would say the other 25 trees that were on the street, it looks like a horror movie. They're not doing anything. They just look like they're dead trees.
And these things were planted how long ago?
10 years ago. You got to remember, the two trees in front of my home, I've actually cut them down because they did not look like they want to come back to life.
Okay.
So my question, there's a 6 foot wide by 38 foot long plot where the two trees were.
Mm-hmm.
They were evenly spaced in front of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And now I want to know, how do I remove the roots, and then what type of tree would I plant there that's going to be a good tolerant tree that's going to grow, prosper, and not give me any issues?
Okay. You can't remove the roots. You absolutely are physically incapable of removing the roots. That needs specialized equipment. I'm thinking the parts of the sidewalk would be torn up, and you'd also have to make sure that there's no piping underground. You wouldn't want to impact the sewer line leaving your house. There might be underground electrical cables. You just cut these trees down yourself. You just cowboyed them down?
Well, actually, I had my landscaper. He came through with a chainsaw, and he hauled them away. And he did it back in, I'm going to say, September, October of last year.
Well, even if you don't impact the sidewalk, it's going to cost you a good $1,000, maybe $2,000 to get the stumps pulled. Do you really need trees there?
I think it would add beauty to the street line and to the development, and I just don't want to be the only one that doesn't have anything there.
And you're the only one whose trees died.
Well, there's other trees that are dead along the street, but no one else has dealt with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do something because I didn't want to have two dead trees in front of my home.
Well, here's your two options. What I would do, because obviously the look of this area is going to change. You can have the trees cut down and ground down to where the stump will be taken down to a little bit below ground. You don't have to worry about water, electrical, or the pavement when you do something like that. And then you could box out the area and build a nice raised bed on top. And in that raised bed, you could plant things that would even achieve the same height, but would grow well within that box. That would save you the money of tearing out the stumps. Again, we don't even know that you can tear out the stumps without causing tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage if there's a sewer line or electrical running under there. Your other option is to go around to these other homeowners in spring. If their trees truly don't leaf out, then maybe you as a community can come up with a common plan so that it would look right if you all did essentially the same thing.
Excellent advice, Mike. Thank you very much for taking my call. And I'm going to follow up with the other homeowners, and we're going to get something that looks uniform and beautiful.
I think that's the answer, man. Good luck.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. 1-888-346-9499. Nate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Nate. How are you?
I'm good.
Where are you, man?
I live in Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. A very nice neighborhood. What can we do for Nate in Chestnut Hill?
I have a series of small raised beds that I use to raise vegetables, and they are all on the north aspect of my house, and I've got a very shaded lot, so we get a minimum of morning sunshine. and some good afternoon sunshine. But I was more interested because the total square footage of this, which I'm dividing up amongst four raised beds, is about 70 square feet. And
that's a tiny little thing, Nate.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, in Western Civ class when I was in, you know, junior high, they talked about feudalism and fallow fields. And I was wondering how much that holds true for sort of yard gardens as opposed to, you know, industrial agriculture.
When you got 70 square feet,
yeah,
you can't afford to let 2 inches go fallow.
Right. Okay.
Now, the only time any of my raised beds have, quote, gone fallow is when I've gotten exhausted in the springtime and would just let a weed take over one for the course of a season. You know, purslane and chickweed are real good at being an unofficial cover crop for that. But no, you don't have to let anything go fallow or use a cover crop or anything like that. As long as you're applying fresh compost to the bed, I'm more concerned about the fact that these poor things are sun starved. What are you growing?
I grow tomatoes and arugula, which we did last year. And what we saw was in that bed particularly, it's on the northwest corner of the house. So it gets sunshine probably starting like around noon, I would guess, in the summertime.
That's
and
rough.
The plants got big, but they didn't bear fruit until kind of late in the summer. And I can't really change the orientation of the beds, unfortunately. The front of the house has a huge maple tree on it, which
right.
is the south exposure.
Okay.
So I was wondering, basically, how can I make the best of that situation?
What did you feed these things?
You know, this is our second year in the place, and we didn't do, you know, much. So, you know, I would be looking to, you know, get compost and fertilizer going. But this year we, you know, planted them in soil that we kind of tilled up on our own.
But you did build raised beds.
Yeah, so the raised beds are there.
And it's in your backyard or an adjacent yard?
Yep, it's in the backyard.
Did you check for lead?
No.
Okay. You're in a nice urban area, but you're still in an urban area. So before you go fooling around with your bare hands in that soil anymore, I want you to go online, go to your state extension service, which is Penn State Soil Lab, and get a lead and heavy metal test done. It's not that expensive, and you may find that you don't want to be inhaling that dirt or growing things in it.
Okay.
You may find out it's perfectly safe, but whenever people are in an urban area, you have to be careful because of the lead paint that was used and even the lead gasoline that was used. A friend of mine wound up buying a house and nobody told him there used to be a car repair shop on the site. And, you know, his lead levels were like through the roof. Now, since you are so challenged, if your soil's safe, that's great. Then just add compost to your raised beds. But if you don't get sun until noontime, I would go crazy with salad greens, with herbs. I would put in some potatoes. You can even plant garlic in the fall. But for fruiting crops like tomatoes and peppers and anything else of that nature you might want to grow, there has to be a great community garden near you.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. And to your point, I mean, the arugula grew like wild, and so did the herb garden. The herb garden got, you know, was overgrown before we knew what to do with it.
Exactly. And so play your aces. There's an old line in agriculture. If you have lack of sun, think roots and shoots, not flowering plants. Flowering plants require the most sun. And disease-prone flowering plants like tomatoes require morning sun. So you're 0-2.
I got it.
On that. But there should be a nice community garden nearby. And then once you've established that your soil is safe, go nuts with herbs, go nuts with greens. I mean, kale, you know, even plants like broccoli, just not things that develop a flower, the flower falls off and then develops a fruit. Those are 8 hours of sun a day, and most of them prefer even more than that. But things like potatoes and salad greens and herbs, they can do quite well in an area like yours.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. That's a big help.
All right. Good luck, Nate.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Elena, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Now, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing your name. How does it go?
Elena.
Elena. Okay, very good. And where are you, Elena?
I live in Royersford outside of Philadelphia.
Very good. What can we do for Elena in Royersford?
We just moved into the area, into a house in June, and we had a very large plant growing on probably an 8-foot trellis. It grows all the way to the top and then over the side. And it had the original sticker on it that said clematis.
Oh, okay.
So when we bought the house, we were expecting these gorgeous characteristic purple blooms. And so we've lived there now throughout most of the end of the summer and the fall and never seen any blooms. And so I was wondering what I could possibly do to help it along a little bit.
Now, when you say it had a sticker on it, was it a plant tag with a scientific name, or was it just some kind of quirky little garden thing that said clematis?
No, it was from the store. It was one of the plant tags that was looped around it.
Excellent, excellent. And do you still have it?
I do, but I don't have it.
No, that's all right. That's right. Like, I'm a clematis expert. Like, you know, I know enough about clematis to get into trouble. But the fact that you have the tag means you're totally okay. And I'm going to tell you what to do. I want you to write down a resource. There is a guy, it's Raymond Evison, E-V-I-S-O-N.
Okay.
He has been on the show many times. He is the most renowned breeder of what he would call, because he's British, clematis in the world. He is renowned. His stuff is in the Royal Gardens. He's been honored at the Philadelphia Flower Show. And his websites are incredibly informative. Now, before we go into what I'm going to tell you to do, there are two rules that clematis of any type must follow. The bottom of the plant has to be in total shade, and the top of the plant has to get full sun.
Okay.
Are those requirements being met?
You know, the bottom probably doesn't have full shade. Probably first thing in the morning it gets some of the dawn.
Oh, but then it's exposed to direct sun the rest of the day?
Yeah, the top is definitely exposed to sun all day.
Okay, that's good.
I think the roots probably get some sun, too.
And you were there towards the mid-end of summer through fall. What was the greenery like?
It's overtaking the whole trellis. I mean, it is a massive plant. It's very fertile, but it's just, I didn't even see any buds at all, nothing.
Okay, but you saw a lot of greenery.
Yes.
Okay, and not a lot of old dead wood.
No.
Okay, good. So there's two things that are going to have to be done. You're going to have to rig up something that's going to shade the base. Seriously, Raymond explained to me on the show, which, you know, because I was saying, how does this happen in nature? And he said when he would go trolling for plants up in like the Himalayas and stuff, they would never find a clematis growing alone. It would be growing up through another plant. And the base of the clematis, where the roots were, would be all the way at the bottom of this big bushy plant. And then the vines would curl through the plant, using the plant for support, and would burst out the top. And that's where you would see the flowers. But the bottom would stay cool and shaded. So, I mean, there might be just some sort of a little box you could make up out of nice-looking wood to box it over, keep that area down by the roots shaded and cool. No matter what, that will help you out. And then find your plant tag. Go to Raymond's website. Once again, it's Raymond Evison, E-V-I-S-O-N. And look up your clematis. You probably have the common name and the scientific name, there are somewhere between 3 and 6 what are called different groups of clematis that must be pruned differently, that flower at different times of the year. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, to give general advice. It's apple trees, I can tell you how to prune any apple tree. Peach trees, I can tell you how to prune any peach tree. You get into clematis, and it's like, oh, I need to know what group it is. Is it a Hugh Jackman? Is it this? Is it that? So using the information on your tag, go to Raymond's website. It'll tell you exactly what group it's in and exactly how to prune it. And it will probably reemphasize the importance of shading the root system.
Okay.
So, but for now, okay, look it up, find out when to prune it so you'll be ready and how to prune it. Shade the bottom, and I suspect you should be in really good shape.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for Mike to take a little break while I announce that he'll be giving his annual lecture at this year's fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show in the Gardener's Studio on the main floor of the show at 6 p.m. on Thursday, March 10th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with good news about bad beetles and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Alexis Landis, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, which has all sorts of information. We'll describe a relative of the Japanese beetle that flies by night, so its damage often goes undetected. We will also tell you about a new control for both of those and all the other scarab beetles that munch on your plants and nasty weevils as well. It's all coming up with more of your fabulous phone calls right after this.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Stephanie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just ducky today. Stephanie, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
And where is Stephanie great?
We are in Newport, Washington.
Is that near Spokane?
It's a little bit farther north than Spokane, about an hour north, about an hour from Canada.
Oh, okay, right. You can see Russia from there, right?
Yeah.
All right, what can we do for Stephanie all the way up in Washington State?
We just moved into our new property out here late last year, and the property we got had some established elderberry bushes or trees and a plum tree. I've never had anything that needed to be pruned, so I have no idea where to start.
When did you move in?
September last year.
So you've only been there a few months, really?
Correct.
So you haven't seen what you got yet?
No. When we moved in, the elderberry bushes gave us some elderberries. We were able to harvest them, and then there were a couple of plums on the tree. We didn't get a whole lot, but I know it's kind of getting to the time of year when they're supposed to be pruned.
Well, first of all, you're very lucky because elderberries contain the most potent antiviral in the plant world.
Yeah, we've done a little bit of reading on it, so we were pretty excited.
So, basically, are the plants really old?
You know, we have no idea.
Are they big? Are they overgrown? Do they look like they've been cared for?
Well, the plum tree, actually, the people before us kind of cut off the top half.
Good.
That one's probably about 10 to 12 feet high, so it's not a small younger tree, and the elderberry bushes are about 8 feet high, so they're not really young, but they do have new growth on both of them.
Okay, so for the elderberries, first of all, you don't have to prune them, but they're going to produce better, and they're going to look cleaner if you go out, and you're right, it's right around this time of year, the end of winter, going into spring. Go out and remove some of the older wood, and that should be obvious. The older, more gnarly branches as opposed to the younger green wood. But mostly they don't need anything. They're kind of wild plants. They get by pretty well on their own. But as they start to get older and overgrown, it's never a bad idea to remove old wood.
Oh, okay, great.
Now, the plums, I'm really going to want you to pay attention to the plums when they flower, because there's all different kind of plum plants, and the flowers will help you determine what you have. When you find out whether you have American or European or Oriental plums, then you can follow some basic guides, but it's almost the same thing. Cut away some of the older wood, keep it open. Basically, the reason they cut the top off the tree, so to speak, is that's what's called establishing a new central leader. With fruit trees, you really don't want them to get too tall because then you can't reach the top to pick the fruit or thin the fruit or anything like that. And if you have a single tree, you know, it's never going to produce as many plums as it would if it had a friend in the area.
Yeah.
So again, very important for you to watch when it flowers this spring. You don't have to do anything to it before that. Take pictures of the flowers, find out where your local extension office is, cut off one of the flowering branches and take it in. And then you can open it up after it flowers. You can take off some of the older branches. And then watch the fruit set. If there's too many fruits, sometimes plums can set so heavily that they'll actually bend and break the branches like pears. So if you get that lucky, remove a lot of the fruits from the overcrowded branches so that it'll be able to develop full-size fruits. But these are both very low-care plants. You really lucked out.
Well, that is great to know. Thank you very much. We love your show. Thanks for your help.
Oh, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rachel, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Fine, fine.
And where is Rachel Fine?
Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Rachel in Doylestown?
I was helping somebody move, and they had leftovers, and they gave me two sealed containers of coffee. Apparently, they were old because they didn't even smell like fresh coffee. So I was wondering, what can I do with unused coffee and also used coffee grounds? What plants like that?
Do you have an outdoor garden?
I have rhododendrons, azaleas, lots of trees.
Okay. Well, you've already named a couple of worthy prospects. Now, it's rare that we get to use, you can't call it fresh coffee, but unbrewed coffee.
Yes.
But the mechanism should still be the same. It's going to be very rich in nitrogen, and it's going to be very acidic. Two of the plants, the azaleas love acidity, and they've already set their flower buds for the season. You know, azaleas set their flower buds in late summer, and then they just persist on the plant over winter. So in the spring, when the plant starts greening up on its way to blooming for the spring, then I would use the coffee as a mulch around the base of the plants.
Okay.
It'll give it a nice feeding, and the nitrogen will get into the plant at such an early stage that it won't impede the formation of blooms later in the summer. That's what you have to worry about when you overuse nitrogen on certain plants. It can actually lessen the flowering effect. But
okay.
So timing is everything. As soon as they start greening up in the spring. And then you said you have hydrangeas?
Yeah, I have hydrangeas, azaleas, and rhododendrons.
Okay, rhododendrons and azaleas are the same plant family.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing is true. They can get, because you said you had used coffee grounds as well, they can get used, they can get fresh. And the best time to apply that is as soon as plants start greening up in the spring.
Before they bloom.
Right. Because the blooms are already set. The bad time to do it would be like right after the blooms fade, because that's when the plant is going to begin to make the new flowers, and you don't want a lot of nitrogen in the soil then. But nitrogen is very ephemeral. The plants will take it up, they'll use it, and then it won't affect them a couple of months from then. And your hydrangeas, are they pink or blue?
They are, let me see, they're pink and blue, and they're the only plants that like shade.
Well, I wouldn't say that they like shade, but I'd say that
you're... Well, they don't like it, but they thrive.
Well, you're taking good care of them if they're blooming well for you in the shade. That shows you got a good hand there, a good thumb there. The coffee grounds will simply feed the plants. You don't want to feed the hydrangeas too early because their flower buds haven't set yet. You want to wait until the flower heads appear, those little, and you can apply it when they're little.
Yes.
You know, when those little mop tops start showing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, it will make your flowers blue.
Okay.
If you like them pink, then you would simply use the coffee grounds on your azaleas and rhododendrons. But if you like the blue hydrangeas, you can, the more coffee grounds you put in their soil, the bluer the flowers are going to be. One trick I like to do at home is I will really dose the back of the plants heavily with coffee grounds or some other high acid nutrient and leave the fronts alone. So you get pink plants up front, and then on the same plant, you've got blue blooms on the back.
That's nice.
Although you can do it the reverse. You can have the blue up front and the pink in the back, whatever you're into. But coffee grounds are great, and if you have a compost pile or you want to start one, shredded leaves and coffee grounds make the absolute best compost.
Okay, good. I have access to a lot of very well-composted shredded leaves.
Okay, mix some coffee grounds into those, and that'll finish the composting very quickly.
Wonderful, wonderful.
All right, Rach, nice to hear from you, and
okay.
Good luck this spring with your coffee ground experiments.
Thank you, Mike.
Take
Always
care.
Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Well, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. A new way to control Asiatic and Japanese beetles. Alexis Landis, please read us what turns out to be this week's groundbreaking question.
Sure, Mike.
Elise writes, I have a raised bed garden in Hollywood, Florida, and recently found a bug feeding on the leaves of my zinnia plants at night. The bug is about a quarter to a half inch long, and I think it may also be harming my basil and bean plants. I was wondering if you could help me identify this pest and if there is a way to get rid of it organically.
Well, at first, the excellent photo she sent and the feeding at night observation made me feel certain that this was the Asiatic beetle, a night-flying cousin of our infamous Japanese beetle.
But?
But when I started to freshen up my research, we last reported on the Asiatic beetle way back in 2010, all the articles specified that this was a pest of the Northeast, Vermont, New Hampshire, Ohio, which was really frustrating because there's a great new way to control these and other destructive beetles I've been dying to talk more about.
Well, we do seem to be talking about them, so what changed?
I got real crazy specific and started searching Asiatic beetles in Florida and actually found a 2013 bulletin from the University of Florida announcing the first confirmed captures of the creatures in their state. And they say they had expected to find them down there much sooner. Now, these reported captures were in Jacksonville, which is all the way at the top of the state, while her garden in Hollywood is in the far southern tip down by Miami. So I think it's safe to assume that they're all over Florida at this point. And this may be the first report of them being that far south. Isn't that cool?
Wow, that is really cool. So remind us of the details on this pest.
Well, it's a scarab beetle, like rose chafers, June beetles, and Japanese beetles. Like the Japanese beetle, it's a pest in both the adult and larval stages. The adults chew on plants, and the grubs eat plant roots underground. It attacks hundreds of different types of plants, but isn't considered to be as destructive as the Japanese beetle, which, when you think about it, is not much of a compliment.
And it's nocturnal, right?
Absolutely. Both Elise in Florida and our listener back in 2010, who was in Great Falls, Virginia, went out after dark to catch it in the act. Now, although they fly by night, they're attracted to light, something you can use to your advantage in two ways. One, if you're in a naturally dark area, don't have any outdoor lights on at night. If you need something for safety, like when you come home late, use motion-activated lights.
You know, I was thinking some people might need to have lights on at night to deter prowlers, but motion-activated lights would probably work even better. The suddenness would startle the bad guys and alert the homeowner. What's the other half of your light advice?
Use light. Make a light trap somewhere on the outskirts of your property. As with Japanese beetle traps, don't place it anywhere near the plants you're trying to protect. You could either hang sticky traps underneath the light, or you can use Japanese beetle traps that can be baited with a special lure that's sold specifically to attract the Asiatic beetle.
Okay, what else?
Well, if you're having a lot of damage, or you're in the north and you had bad damage the year before, consider releasing beneficial nematodes as soon as the soil is warm in the spring, and or about a month after the adults have disappeared in late summer. These microscopic good guys will burrow down into the soil and attack any beetle grubs that are feeding on your plant roots.
Right. We've recommended them in the past for beetle grub and outdoor flea control. They prey on grubs and flea larvae, but won't hurt earthworms or other good creatures. So what's this new weapon you keep teasing?
BTG, the newest form of BT. It was only released last year, and it looks to be a blessing for people with beetle problems, especially these plant-devouring scarab beetles, which were its primary intended target during the research stage.
Were? Does that mean it affects other insects?
Yeah, weevils, like the destructive pepper weevil and the pecan weevil. Now, the G in BTG stands for Galleria, and it comes in two forms. One for use against larval grubs in the soil, and another that you spray on the leaves of plants under attack.
Are they different strains of BTG?
No, both are a strain of BT that's known as SDS502. I suspect that they're formulated differently. One, to make it easy to spread evenly and disperse well in wet soil, and the other one to move easily through a sprayer and then stick well to the plant leaves.
And this strain of BT works against grubs, beetles, and weevils?
Yeah, you can even add borers to the list, but they're all technically beetles. Weevils are a type of beetle, and they're similar enough to Japanese, Asiatic, Oriental, and other scarab beetles that this BT affects them as well. So like the other BTs, this new BTG only works against one type of insect, but it's an insect that comes under a lot of different common names. And, most important, those insects have to eat the sprayed leaves, or in this case maybe the drenched roots, to be effective.
But no effect on birds, bees?
No. All of the BTs are very pest-specific and therefore environmentally friendly. They're probably the safest weapons we have in the organic gardening arsenal. Well, that was good news about bad beetles and wicked weevils now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to more information about the new BTG, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. And that's it. We're out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, as long as you include your location, at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where we really don't care about your location, and where you will probably find the answers to the questions you are going to email us about, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and write something at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website weevil-free, currently with the assistance of the lovely Sarah Kazar. Yearning for Florida is Alexis Landis, who proudly produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Editor Al Banks beats the BT out of our show. Our production assistant is the beneficial Eileen Kelly. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Once upon a time, I flew by night. And you know, occasionally I was called a weevil. But these days, I'm in bed by 10, so I can see you again next week. A new mosquito-borne virus has people worried sick. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll review the rules of mosquito prevention as we try and help assess the real risks of the Zika virus. Plus your fabulous phone calls.